Welcome to another episode of Good Night Tanzania with myself, Osama. Good Night Tanzania is a podcast meant to help ordinary South African people understand a little better where they're from historically, so that we together can come to understand the present. On all social media platforms, I am Osama Simone, and the podcast is Good Night Tanzania. I hope you'll like, subscribe, and comment with your views so that I may know what you think, of course. Let's see what's on the menu today. Welcome to another episode of Good Night Tanzania, everyone. On today's episode, we're going to be speaking about the late farming communities in Southern Africa, and we'll find out a bit what we mean by that. But just to recap on why necessarily this particular topic, a couple of episodes ago, we were joined by John, who spoke a bit about hunter-gatherers and Stone Age people all over the world, and saying, sort of suggesting that, you know, people have been not Stone Age people for less than they have been Stone Age people, that for close to 3 million years, people were living, you know, a sort of Stone Age life. And it's only in the recent couple of thousands of years that people changed their lifestyles. And then we are also joined by Gavin to hear a bit more about farming societies of early Southern Africa. But that discussion obviously didn't take us to the present, because it was also very, you know, very intense and very involved. So today we are going to pick up from where Gavin left off to try to understand, you know, the late farming communities and perhaps what these communities might have in relation to people who live in South Africa today. But we'll get to find out a bit more about that. And to help us understand, you know, this question of, you know, of continuity, I suppose, and then changes, we're joined by Alex Schoeman. Alex is an associate professor in archaeology at the University of the Witwatersrand, PhD in archaeology from the university, focused on rain control and the rise of the K2 Mapungubwe state. Which we'll find out a bit more later on in the discussion. She continues to explore elements related to her PhD, such as a farmer-hunter-gatherer interaction. She also has an ongoing interest in the archaeology of gender, as well as the archaeology of farming. She currently leads the NRF-funded Bokoni Farmscapes Project, which is making a significant contribution to understandings of the complexity of pre-colonial farming in Africa. Currently, the project is exploring the people of Bokoni's relationships with the social, economic, physical, and environmental conditions under which Bokoni farmers established a system of stone-built terrace agriculture that left such an extensive archaeological footprint in Mpumalanga. So welcome, Alex, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mzamo.
But before we get to the discussion more in depth manner, could you please share with us the reasons why you decided to become an archaeologist and your overall experiences so far as a researcher and a teacher at the university at Wits.
I stumbled across archaeology as in school, in one of those guidance handbooks. And there was a thing about pottery and that you could trace African histories through pottery. And for me, that was the most radical thing possible, because I grew up in apartheid South Africa. And often Black people were portrayed as not having a history. And suddenly there's this tool that allows us to write a history that's different, that's not white, that is about the real history of this country. And that's how I came across archaeology. And then eventually I came to Wits, and I fell in love with the degree, but also with the radicalness of the potential insights into our past. And I came to Wits in 1989, which is at the end of apartheid. And I think much has changed in the last 20 years in the discipline and the country, but also how we think about society. And it's been exciting to see those societal changes, thinking about the impact of colonialism, trying to decolonize understanding, to see that taking place in archaeology and to see how it impacts on our discipline. And teaching with WITS is always fun and always tough. And students come up with amazing insights and questions that can stump. And that's mm-hmm. where we are at the moment.
Now, to get into the deeper details of today's episode, I'd just like to briefly get into, you know, the relation between archaeology and history for a non-specialist audience. Like, how would you explain, you know, what you do and how it relates to the overall archive?
I think in the old days, there were very firm boundaries between various disciplines of knowledge acquisition. And they were as much about the method as they were about politics and boundary keeping. I think those boundaries have blurred in the last 10 years, or maybe a bit longer. And so the relationship with history as a method, I mean, I think archaeologists use that more and more to understand the recent past. And many historians of Africa rely on archaeology. So there isn't a fixed boundary between the two disciplines. And there are methodological differences. So the most basic one is that archaeologists excavate. So we look at the material record, and we then interpret that through all the sources that we can find. And that includes written sources, oral histories, and other accounts. Historians predominantly rely on the spoken and written word, and they don't excavate. But the information flows between those two disciplines. And all of that then shapes the archive. And it shapes our understanding of South African history and our past.
And just to get into the late farming communities discussion, through the research that I've done, I've interacted a lot with this idea of the Zimbabwe culture. But obviously, I understand that people, you know, contemporary listeners wouldn't necessarily quite understand what that means off the bat, because today, you know, there's a modern state, you know, named after Great Zimbabwe, which is called Zimbabwe, and can you just please explain to us what was meant by the Zimbabwe culture and its origins within the context of, you know, the Southern African region?
The Zimbabwe culture is an academic creation in part, and it stems from a period of labeling things. I mean, I think our approach to the term is different now from the way it was invented, but I'll start with the way it was originally used. And the use stems from archaeology. So there are similarities between the material culture found in northern Limpopo in the Shashi-Limpopo confluence area, related to the Mapungubwe state, and material culture found in large parts of Zimbabwe, Botswana, parts of Mozambique, etc. And based on the similarities, so for example, hilltop occupations, use of stonewalling in some way, international trade, and some interaction in terms of ceramics. This model was built up that Great Zimbabwe developed out of Mapungubwe, and that there are descendant states such as the Venda state, Mutapa, the Kami state. And all of those things together were labeled as the Zimbabwe culture. And it's then spanned a good 700-800 years. That sort of very monolithic unitary process has been questioned by a new generation of Zimbabwean archaeologists. And what this new generation of archaeologists have suggested is that what we're seeing from about 1000 AD, a little bit earlier, are several competing polities or states in northern South Africa, Botswana, and Zimbabwe. And they overlap, they compete, they collaborate, with one another through time, and the relationship isn't fixed. And they've sort of raised questions about this monolithic Zimbabwe culture. But I think there is, in spite of that subtlety, there is agreement that there's some form of continuity, some form of interaction for the best part of the second millennium from the Limpopo North. And so that is generally what's referred to as Zimbabwe culture, is that related complex of sites that include Great Zimbabwe, Mapungubwe, Kami, etc.
And if we can just zoom in, I just want to perhaps get into, you know, the latest discoveries, I suppose, because, you know, the research that I read, I think, obviously, given in within the context of the consultations that you've spoken about, could have been revised. But is it still the case that, you know, that development of, you know, of a state started out initially with the settlement of people called the Zizo people, who are known to have spoken a version of Shona, or has that also potentially, you know, is that potentially also under review?
I think there's still agreement that the Tswe Zizo complex of sites is the earliest. So those date back to the first millennium, Zizo specifically to 900 AD, but Tswe is a bit earlier, and that complex is still the earliest part of it. I think where the contestation comes in is in the K2 Mapungubwe period. So it's 1000 AD onwards. And that is seen as contemporaneous with developments in Zimbabwe, in the Great Zimbabwe complex.
And could you briefly just tell us how the developments proceeded from the Zizo settlement to the Mapungubwe state? Because I also understand that the Mapungubwe state's sort of plays a large role in the national imagination of South Africanness, I guess, because there's also, you know, that Order of Mapungubwe, which is an award for excellence in different fields. And I'm sure listeners might be wondering what Mapungubwe has, you know, like what sort of dynamics, you know, were sort of involved there or at play there.
I mean, Zizo is a spectacular site, and it's this moment in the history of South Africa where we see international connections. So we stop from focusing inward and within the continent, and we start getting evidence of international connection. But it's also those internal regional collections that are crucial. So for your listeners, a bit of an archaeology lecture. Mm-hmm. Zizo, the earliest date for it is 900 AD, and it lasts until about 1000 AD. So it's a 100-year occupation at a specific site that is very close to the Limpopo River. Mm-hmm. And it's the core of a polity centered around the Shashi-Limpopo River confluence area. And at Zizo, there was a chief. There's clearly a hierarchical site, and there's evidence for ivory working. They're clearly farming, probably sorghum and millet, and they have cattle. They're also doing a fair amount of game hunting, and the economy includes international trade. And that trade links them to the Indian Ocean, all the way up through India to the east, and they're we have glass beads at Schroeder, and a lot of them that came from through that network. And the trade didn't, Zizo polity and Schroeder, the site itself, didn't result from the trade, but the leaders at that site took the opportunity and used trade to further expand the polities and the states that they were building. And so it enhanced the economies that pre-existed, and it probably used earlier networks of exchange and barter that would have included food and ivory between African kingdoms, polities, and it extended those networks into the international world. And then from there, there's continuous evidence of independent trade from Africa with the East for the next 500-600 years. And the Mapungubwe economy then expands those, and we start to see in the Kato period, which is 1000 to 1200 AD, and then specifically in the Mapungubwe period, 1200 to 1300 AD, we start to see the intensification from that. So Zizo was relatively small little capital, 500 people maybe, The next period with K2, there are at least 2,000 people at the capital in Mapungubwe, where there are 5,000 people. So the economy intensified and expanded and developed to allow a group of people to live at the capital who are not all necessarily producing their own food through farming. And that means there's surplus production by other people in the system that allows this town building to start. And by the end of Mapungubwe, we have a fairly modern economy in many ways, based on intense food production in the floodplain, cattle roaming all the way to the Soutpansberg, which is about 100 kilometers away, deep into Zimbabwe. So you have some form of centralized management or collective management of big herds, because obviously it needs to be safe. You're not going to let your cattle graze in Pretoria if you live in Johannesburg, if you don't know that your cattle will be well received in Pretoria. And so that talks about cohesion in society and the ability to ensure that cohesion. And metal trade, Mapungubwe itself is not exactly mineral rich, but not far away in Messina, the gold and copper deposits, trade in iron. So you have a modern-ish economy already at Mapungubwe. And that's why Mapungubwe matters for South Africans, because it's where we first become international players. It's where we show our mettle as South Africans to create a very complex society with massive levels of social cohesion, irrespective of multiple people living in the society in a very arid area. I mean, even today, Mapungubwe gets about 350 millimeters of rain per year. That's very little. That's about half, if not less than half, of Johannesburg's rainfall. And in spite of that, farmers were able to produce enough food for 20,000 people living in that kingdom and 5,000 people at the capital. And that's the basic of why Mapungubwe matters.
And how long does the Mapungubwe state last for, and what relationship does it have with Great Zimbabwe?
The Mapungubwe state, as the expression, as the height, is a very short-lived expression. It's 100 years. But I think it's much more useful if we think of that 400 years during which the Shashilimpopo Conference area is the center of trade, of networks meeting, of agricultural production in South Africa, the biggest one. And that's a 400-year period. Certainly towards the end of that period, Great Zimbabwe is very much flourishing or starting to flourish, and there is an overlap. And it's very likely that there was competition for international trade, but also collaboration networks of exchange of goods. So Zimbabwe as a whole, for example, has lots of gold resources that are close to the surface. And gold was an important product in Mapungubwe, and it's not inconceivable that there was some form of trade between the two centers. But there probably was also competition. I mean, I think it was two modernizing communities and two very different contexts. And the relations are similar to modern or historic relations between two different communities that neighbor. And sometimes it's friendly, sometimes it's not.
Because I was under the impression that there were some continuities between the two states, but I suppose obviously because my understanding is guided by also the conversations that you opened with at the beginning of our discussion.
Are similarities. I think that's a better way to phrase it than continuities. So, for example, they both have what is referred to as the Zimbabwe pattern, where there's evidence for elite occupation on the hilltop, commoners live in the valley. So a class system of kind. And so they form part of the similar complex, but it doesn't mean that one developed out of the other one. So it's the same as, let's just think of it, Xhosa and Zulu. Mm-hmm. they are ancestral in some way, because Xhosa people do have origins further north as well, but they're also different. So it is a cultural relationship as well as similar roots, but it doesn't make them the same thing.
And now to redirect our attention towards the south of the Limpopo-Shashe Valley, what communities of farmers do we find in these areas in southern Africa, and how do they relate to the farming communities of the first millennium in the same area?
I think that is the million-dollar question, and I think that is where quite a bit of research will focus in the coming years. In the old days, there was sort of this assumption that they were very different and that one replaced the other. So early farming communities, certainly the archaeologists suggest a diffusion down into southern Africa about 2,000 years ago, which would be the period that you spoke to John about. So before that was just hunter-gathering. And then there's a diffusion of pastoralism, possibly some migration, ditto with farmers, some migration, some diffusion, some local adoption of farming, give or take 2,000 years ago. And then out of those early farming communities that lived over much of the eastern part and the northern part of South Africa, where you can grow crops during summer, developed into Zizo, Mapungubwe, but also processes in KwaZulu-Natal where people start to trade. Somewhere around 1000 AD, at the turn of the millennium, different types of pottery start to appear in southern Africa. And it's possible and probable that some of that relates to some form of population movement, and that some of it relates to local invention. So there's some evidence of local invention that Karim Sidaris looked at. And then people like Thomas Huffman and others have traced elements of migration. And that migration and population diffusion does show in DNA in a range of ways. And these later farming communities then come with a different approach in some ways to residential locations. So for example, early farming communities favored living close to rivers. In the second millennium, with later farming communities, they tend to prefer living upslope. And there are cultural reasons for that. So for example, the river snake and other indigenous beliefs of reasons why you don't live close to the river. But that's a key difference. They all would have been Black Africans, so that's the same, and their language would have had similar roots. And within that then lies the answer to where these late farming communities are as well. So they are the ancestors of Xhosa-speaking people, Zulu-speaking people, Tswana-speaking people, Pedi-speaking people, etc. And partially the ancestors of Venda-speaking people. And quickly deal with Venda before I return to the other ones. So Venda in part develops out of the Zimbabwe complex. So one third, it's a guesstimate of ancestors of Venda speakers are probably Mapungubwe people that remained in the area after the fall of the Mapungu state. Mm-hmm. One third probably relates to Great Zimbabwe and that political complex, because we can see that linguists can see that in the Venda language. And one third comes from some of these new arrivals who spoke an ancestral Sotho language. And all of those things mix up in Venda language. And so that they, in a sense, embody both early and later farming communities. Later farming communities such as Zulu speakers and Khoi speakers and Pedi speakers are mostly related to that second millennium rather than the Zimbabwe period. But they're also sort of with new glasses on, with new ways of looking, we're starting to see continuities even in those communities with the first millennium. So there are little bits similarities in the pottery suggesting there's continuities. And recent DNA work by Stain et al. Published last year, so just quite early on, so in the middle of the first millennium, four women who are from Nguni-speaking or Zulu-speaking later farming communities had DNA that was indigenous and derived from Khoisan people as well as other forms of DNA that link into the rest of Africa. So these later farming communities are partly new, but they also probably incorporated people already here, whether those are San speakers, early farming communities, or pastoralists. And I think that's where, that's goes back to your question, that's where the new research is starting to happen, is that relationship. And thinking it about in a decolonial way, because in the old model, it was really much a displacement model. New people come and they displaced all people. Now, in part, it was justifying white colonialism, in which Black people were removed from land. But it also came out of an ideology that was dominant in European archaeology, where it was seen as constant displacement of one group by another. But with new lenses, that relationship, I think, is going to be super funky, what the next generation of archaeologists get out of that.
And obviously, whilst trying to, you know, steer clear from, you know, those colonial and apartheid sort of constructions of ethnicity, I'm interested also in sort of tracing, you know, the movements of the new arrivals in the late, you know, in the second millennium, and how those could sort of have trickled down or sort of have given birth to modern sort of South African, you know, or South African people in that sense. I understand that there was sort of there's the Blackburn and sort of sites, mm-hmm. there's different sites that you've looked at and when you've dated them to different points in the past. And can you just tell us about the different sites and how those sites sort of, you know, give a picture or a revealing of different sort of streams of movement?
Yes, there's some really cool archaeology that speaks to it. And you've mentioned some of the names, Blackburn and Moore Park. So those are sites in KwaZulu-Natal. Moore Park is near Estcourt. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with KwaZulu-Natal, but for those that are firmly grounded in Joburg, it's on the way to Natal, sort of halfway in between. Mm-hmm. And they're significant sites. So they date to that sort of 900,000 period, that turn of the millennium. And it's the first expression that we see of types of pots that are similar to pots that become Zulu and Xhosa pots. Mm-hmm. And for people with links into those areas, they might remember that their grannies had these black pots with these bumps on them, or cut triangles or shapes. And you still see potters selling their work in Joburg, that are those black pots. They tend to be soccer ball form. And the ancestors in KwaZulu-Natal made those pots. So we can trace those lineages from Blackburn Moor Park into contemporary Nguni-speaking communities, whether they're Zulu, Swazi, Xhosa, Corni, partly Ndebele. And so those roots go back up to East Africa somewhere, where there are similar bits of pottery that we can see running through time. There's also some genetic evidence that supports that. Some form of process that is similar in the Eastern Cape to genetics that are similar in East Africa. So there are links between these communities that we see in the pottery, and we can see it in genetics, but also in languages. So South Africans, majority of South Africans speak a language that calls people with the NTU suffix or the core. And that is common throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And so they are relatives in that process, and they came here 1,000 years ago. And then from that KwaZulu-Natal home base, and obviously the Eastern Cape, it expanded into other parts of South Africa. So the expansion into Mpumalanga of Sakoni speakers, they have their origins in KwaZulu-Natal. Some of the Nzunza praise poetry link back their links to Tugela in KwaZulu-Natal, and the early pottery might be similar as well. The other part of South Africa, if it tends to be a Sotho language cluster, as your listeners would know,
And that has two sets of roots. So one, partly rise in Blackburn and a mixture, but it also lies in a different tradition of pottery. So if people think back again to their granny's pottery, or for older people, their parents' pottery, it tends to be decorated in beautiful ochre and graphite designs, black and red with incisions. Whether that's Pedi or Tswana pottery or Corny, doesn't really matter. And that has its roots in a pottery style that first appears at a site called Icon in the Zuidpensburg. And that's at about 1200 AD. And from there, we can see that pottery tradition expanding throughout Southern Africa, or parts of Southern Africa. And so the Icon pottery makers ultimately are ancestral to Sotho Tswana speakers, and the Blackburn pottery makers are ancestral to all Nguni language speakers. But there has been interaction as well. So for example, there's evidence that elements of Tswana pottery in the Northwest has roots that go back to KwaZulu-Natal as well. So there was cross relations between these big language clusters.
I imagine that you've used a different word. I am familiar with Muluku for the Sotho Tswana tradition.
Muluku is the cluster name. Yeah.
And how, because obviously these are very early in the second millennium. What are the dynamics, I suppose, as the different societies, you know, sort of have settled over long periods of time? Have you been able to get a sense of the social, political, and the economic dynamics that sort of have guided or have been a force in these societies and the exchanges between them as well?
I think that's been the focus of quite a bit of research in the recent past, is all those dynamics, because they're so different. So thinking to historic KwaZulu-Natal about 100 years ago, tend to get these scattered homesteads on the mountains, a lot of emphasis on cattle. It's very similar in the Eastern Cape. This is, if you go to the Northwest, there were much more dense towns, and that's the result of historical development. So I'm going to take you region by region and just talk a little bit about it.
Okay,
so from
great.
That early Icon period, where people made the red and black ceramics known as Moloko, with that expansion, people move into areas that are suited to different things. So, for example, in Botswana, it's relatively dry. And so it's never going to be an agricultural mecca. But they specialize in cattle farming. And the same goes in parts of the Northwest, where rain is quite sporadic. And what develops are these massive Tswana towns. We're talking 20, 30, 40,000 people in the 1700s at the height of it. So places like Kaditswene, and then more recently, Palatswe, et cetera. And they're very large aggregated towns focused on cattle. So there are lots of cattle enclosures belonging to individual families. They're located in places where there's good grazing, where there's suitable rainfall or water to drink for cattle. But there's also some, you know, reasonable access to farming land. And so somebody called Simon Hall, who's a professor at UCT, and Jan Boyens at UNISA have done a lot of work on these Tswana towns. And so Kaditswene, the historical drawings of the town made by Reverend Campbell. So we know what it looked like. And it was part of a dual capital, but it was a massive place near where Groot Marika is. And that town, which is fully stonewalled, so everything from the front yard wall to the backyard wall, all of that sits in quite dense towns. That developed out of earlier approaches where people were struggling with how to make a town work with all these cattle. And through time, stonewalling started to play that role. But it also, in if you think of living in Joburg in the present, in the suburbs, or in Soweto, it's quite important to know where your property ends and where the neighboring property starts. Otherwise, you plant your tomatoes and then the neighbor's goat comes and eat it. So you need boundaries. And what happened in the Tswana towns is they put up boundaries to ensure good neighborliness. And to demarcate what's mine, what's private, that's public. And if your listeners Google Kadit Sweni on Google Earth, they'll get amazing pictures of the big stone wall towns. There are some in the Magaliesberg as well. But that comes out of an economy that ends up focusing on cattle a lot. In Mpumalanga, there's a community that I've been working on. They used to be Sokoni speakers. Unfortunately, language has largely disappeared as an independent language and it's become part of Pedi. But they had the opposite history. So they settled in the area, the ancestors settled in the area that was really good for farming. Good rainfall, good mist belt, very fertile soils. And they invented terrace farming at about 1500 AD, between Mashadadorp, which is now on the way to the Kruger National Park. And
is this along the escarpment?
Just along the escarpment. Sort of that bit where it's not quite high felt and it's just about to drop down into the low felt.
Okay.
And they became specialist farmers by the 1700s, before the major droughts. They recreated massive terraced landscapes out of much of that area. And we've recently obtained LiDAR images that just shows the extent of this. And they focused on farming. So they built terraces, so they could fertilize them, they could aerate the soil, they could add organics, and they probably exported crops. And their key one of their concerns was to make sure that these terraces farms are safe. And so they invented roads, and these towns are connected through a series of road networks that made sure that the neighbors and the neighbors' cattle didn't walk on the terraces. And so that Bokoni becomes the agricultural mecca of Mpumalanga.
Mm-hmm.
If we go further south to Joburg and into the Free State, there's Klipriviersberg in a series of sites similar to the sites in the northwest, where people built towns in different ways. So there was a Tswana town, or probably a Tswana town, in Joburg, 500, 600 years ago, that expresses that concern with cattle. And then we zoom into KwaZulu-Natal, which had its entirely own dynamic, where it went through different phases. So obviously under Chaka and that sort of 1700-1800 period, we start seeing big towns and forms of state building that are echoed in other parts of South Africa. So, for example, at the same time that the Pedi state develops, they compete for international trade, but also partly defending themselves against slave raiding, slave trading, other expanding states like Ndwandwe that are competing for territory resources, etc. But before that, we see archaeologically scattered homesteads where it's focused on individual families or clans rather than developing these big towns. It was a more dispersed system in most of KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape. And one of the ways that your listeners might be able to think about the politics or pre-colonial politics is to think about contemporary practices. So, for example, in the Pedi world, which is a centralized state, these big towns, initiation of boys are collective. So you get 1,000, 2,000 people at the school when that is held. Same with Ndebele speakers. In the Eastern Cape, boys' schools are much smaller. They're not these massive things. And mm-hmm. the reason for that goes back to this peak colonial period where there was a choice to form towns, form states, form clusters, or to be more scattered. And the choice in the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal before state formation was to be more scattered. And that carries on, memories of that carries on into contemporary practices.
And I've just, as an aside, I understand that the rise of the Zulu Kingdom has sort of altered or tempered with the oral record based on just what people can recollect and what people sort of talk about as being, you know, the defining moments of a past life. How does the rise of the Zulu Kingdom sort of create problems for the archaeological, you know, sort of synergies with the oral record?
It's a difficult one because there are strong oral traditions about the state, the rise of the state, the role of women in the state, often forgotten role of women warriors, and then what happened before. Because obviously it was important for that leaders in that period of states to write their own history and to get rid of inconvenient histories, very similar to leaders across the world who undermine or erode the histories of earlier people. And that does create a problem. But that's also where archaeology comes into its own. So unlike historians, we're not solely reliant on oral histories. Excavations allows us to see beyond that. So for example, Martin Hall and Tim Maggs excavated a site called Tlabeni in KwaZulu-Natal, which is the Kumalo site. And obviously Kumalos then later moved out of that area. Where we can see the ideology of Kumalo political economy before the rise of Chaka or during. And the same with excavations at some of the Zulu capitals that have allowed archaeology to see the nature of the space of those sites and test the oral history, to test the historical accounts and to create that conversation. Because it's not purely about supplementing data, it's also about checking data. And sometimes people tell stories as current leaders in some states in North America tend to tell stories that are not very factually accurate. And it's to test that and to see what the archaeology actually tells us about the process. So if these leaders claim to have massive capitals, we can excavate them. And in the case of the Zulu state, that has been done and those capitals did exist. But it's also clear that some of it is invention. And that's the real challenge for archaeologists and historians, we're not the cheerleaders of the past. We're in fact investigations and testing whether things that are claimed are in fact real.
And it's still on that point. I also understand that the arrival of the single sort of branch of vendor identity also sort of created an like alterations to the oral records, where, you know, the political dominance was obviously trying to create an entire worldview. And could you please just, you know, sort of clarify how those have been disproven as well?
Just to take us back a step to where the vendor singer thing comes from. So the singer are people who speak a Shona language and they come from the Kami Kingdom. The Kami Kingdom in itself is one of the kingdoms in the Zimbabwe state. Starts give or take around the 1500s, and then it carries on through time into the 1800s. In the 1700s, there appears to be some competition instability in the Kami Kingdom, and some people leave, and one of those groups were the Singa royals. And they come then to southern Africa, to the Soutpansberg, where they find people already living. And the people already living there were not unified politically. We can archaeologically see they have scattered homesteads, but they make similar pottery. They probably have some form of language that's the same, and it is probably Venda, because that's what the pottery is telling us. But they scattered, and the Senga then takes over that region and politically unifies it. And with that political unification, they then impose their oral histories. So they try and wipe out the earlier histories. But that's also the joy of careful reading of oral histories. So they do a oral history takeover, but their counter accounts that continue. And there are metaphors in Venda language that speaks to that. So you have the hill, the pool, metaphors. And what happens is the Senga take over the hill, which means they take over political power. And they displace the pool, which is ritual power. And that then goes to the Vangona. But simultaneously, and that's the accounts of that in the oral traditions, and the metaphors are used. But simultaneously, Vangona oral traditions are counter narratives in that process. And so what archaeologists have done, particularly Yanni Loebscher, who's now in the States, he took his departure point as the oral traditions, but he was also testing them. And so what the Senga oral traditions claim is that they formed the Venda state. But the archaeologists are suggesting that Venda as a cultural unit pre-existed, and that the language probably was already there in part, and that there was some form of cultural hegemony. But the Senga state then politically unified that. And we can see that moment of political unification in archaeology in when people or the royals particularly move on to hilltop sites and commoners remain in the valley. And one of the most famous sites in Limpopo, Dzata, is one of those early Senga royal sites to which contemporary Venda royal families can still trace their ancestors. And so it's again that balance between what elite royals claim and what the archaeology and the commoners can attest to.
Like as my reading of Saul Plaquie's novel, for example, which sort of looks into, you know, the pre-colonial Tswana past, you know, sort of speaks of a period of conflict. And I was wondering if you're able to assess for conflict, you know, within, you know, like terrains or landscapes in archaeology, and if so, what have you been able to make of you know the quote unquote like periods of conflict or upheaval in the 1700s to going towards the 1800s?
I mean, I think that's an excellent question. And I mean, there's memories that people like Saul Plaquie drew from. So what people like Saul Plaquie did and other writers were drawing on memories that were so powerful through Southern Africa, accounts of cannibals. They were hanging around in the air, and that's what was being drawn on. Archaeologically, we can see that and we can't see that. It's complicated. So we can see people moving into, when violence is extreme, we can see people moving to spaces that otherwise they wouldn't live in. So Simon Hall excavated a site towards the Free State, sort of on that boundary between Gauteng and the Free State, where people actually moved into a cave underground because the violence was so extreme. The communities in the northwest that moved onto hilltops in Mpumalanga, Sekoni speakers moved into these deep ravines onto mountaintops the Nzinzindebele move on to mountains. So there's lots of evidence where people move to places that otherwise not hospitable. They're not safe. I mean, they're safe, but they're not comfortable. And there's increasing evidence for that from the late 1700s. That coincides with the state formation I spoke about earlier. Also coincide with intensification of slave export from Mozambique. And it coincides with shifts in rainfall in the late 1700s to the early 1800s. There was a massive drought that wrecked part of southern Africa. And so you basically had the perfect storm in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And there was starvation, and those the oral accounts and historical accounts of the great droughts of that period and how people, how crops just failed and how people had to find other ways to find food. And some of that included conflict. And conflict between communities and those responses.
Mm-hmm. And but I also understand that the, during that same period, it's increasingly become an appropriate to link, you know, social transformations to just those intra-group conflicts, which are obviously led, you know, driven by, you know, competition over resources, for example. And, you know, the arrival of, you know, the spread of the colonial frontiers from the Cape. What dynamics within groups now have you been able to identify as sort of being a driver also or a catalyst for these rapid changes?
I mean, I think there are two things that happen. So there is the conflict, but there's also collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So in Mpumalanga, for example, the Nzinzindebele were attacked in the early 1800s by Mzilikazi, according to oral traditions, find refuge with Pedi neighbors. And we see marriage alliances being formed. We see a range of regional alliances. So for example, in Mpumalanga, people use the same pottery, which talks about women moving between communities enough to create some form of shared ceramic style. But they also become conscious of the impact of colonialism. And there are wonderful accounts in the written British and Boer records when they start getting worried about African leaders visiting one another in the late 1800s. And they're worried that what they're starting to see is African unity. And in fact, that is what was starting to happen. And that later then manifests in the 1900s in the formation of the liberation movements.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that collaboration. And I mean, I think part of there's an apartheid myth that sort of runs through part of that is that because people speak different languages, because they had different areas, they were at odds with one another. Rather than just recognizing that when that contact was less frequent in the earlier period because travel was quite difficult. And then what happens through this slave raiding colonial period is that interaction increases drastically. And alliances are formed and new forms of dynamics are created with resistance to colonialism, but also with trying to survive this really complex environmental period. And so some of that manifests in the archaeology of the Northwest. So we see leaders rejecting Christianity versus leaders accepting Christianity, the two towns of Ntsweng and Palatswe, one led by Seretse Khama as ancestors, and the other one by somebody rejecting this colonial frontier. And they're different. And those dynamics then play out in trying to figure out what's the best way to respond to the advancing colonial frontier and people making different choices. In other areas, people push tradition because that is seen as a salvation. Or people adopt elements of the new frontier square houses, for example, by the Nzunza King, who embraced new things in an attempt to survive this onslaught. And so sort of roots of modern approaches start to seep through, where people make choices, and particularly leaders make choices, what they think is going to be best to allow their people survive, whether that's surviving drought. Innovative forms of agriculture, for example, do spring up on hillsides, or whether it is about making political allegiances with other Africans or with colonial incomers in an attempt to weather the storm. People do all of those things, and archaeologically, we can see those choices.
It's all very interesting, actually, and you've helped us unpack it so much from 900 AD to basically the 19th century. But I'm also interested in up and coming research and in the late farming communities, how we as ordinary citizens who are not necessarily scholarly in our dispositions, how we can keep up with the research that you are always churning out as researchers.
I think, journals are not always accessible. And I think that's the ongoing struggle with things sitting behind paywalls. And so the first thing for citizens, I think, is to fight paywalls. And academics obviously are engaged in that battle as well. And open access journals is the way to go. And there are couple of very high quality journals produced in South Africa. So they, Southern African Humanities and the South African Archaeological Bulletin. And some of the articles are a bit dense, but a lot of are easy to read. But also the biggest source for cutting edge research are masters and PhD theses produced at universities. I've just had a student, Angie Masola, submit a really good master's that looked at Mochomatse, which is the Sekone capital in the 1600s. And that's once, obviously it's more complicated than the cupboard, but it will be accessible on the WITS thesis website for free. It's EDT WITS, and UCT has a similar site, so does University of Pretoria. And that's the real cutting edge stuff, because this generation of kids coming through university, doing their masters, doing their PhD, not only are doing cool, sound methodological research, but they also have new ideas and new ways of approaching data. And eventually those theses will be published in academic journals, but the actual theses are there. So they are available to read. Very often when I kind of do a survey of the field, those theses is where I start, because that's telling me what the upcoming generation are really thinking and doing.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. You've really helped us, move closer to a point of understanding, a past that has, been buried in a specific way, because, in the, the heritage narrative sort of focuses on the liberation movement and the 20th century without really giving much background as to, where people, can ultimately trace their genealogies too, and so thank you so much for, accepting.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening. I hope to catch up with you next week on another episode of Good Night, Tanzania. Good night, Tanzania. Indeed,